Hello and welcome to All Things Being Sequel with me, Eric.
And me, Liam. So we've been talking about this show for 18 months maybe, but we finally made it a reality. We're going to speak to some of the most interesting people in the world of data analytics, talk through their career, current challenges leading data teams, which I'm sure there are going to be plenty, and then their thoughts on emerging technologies, let's be honest, LLMs, and the general state of the data market.
Yeah, we just wrapped up speaking to our first guest, and we're super pumped about having spoken to Lucy Alexander, Director of Insight Analytics at the Financial Times on today. And it was super interesting, both to hear about how she works, as well as how things work at an organization like DFT, such a big and renowned organization.
Yeah, it was loads of fun, actually. So I spoke to Lucy on and off for a little while, so I knew she'd be a good guest, but I thought it was super interesting. We kind of challenged her on quantifying the value of an analytics team or department, which I think is pretty common just now on LinkedIn and other places. And she totally didn't shy away from the fact that you have to be able to quantify it. That's part of the job. She obviously said a lot more than that, but I'll let you, everyone, go listen to it. But yeah, I thought it was a really, really interesting part.
Also, we are obviously in the startup world, so it was really, really interesting to hear how things operate in the sort of more established brands that she's worked at, like DFT, Channel 4, Burberry, and even Asus.
I'm going to put Eric on the spot now because we were inspired by somebody else post-recording with Lucy to ask people about their most controversial data opinion. So I want to make that a feature of the show. I'll retrospectively ask Lucy and we'll put it somewhere else. But since we're here, Eric, what's your most controversial data opinion?
So something I've been thinking about the last couple of days, a lot of people are talking about how AI will kind of blow new life into the modern data stack, if you will. I think it'll be a little bit the opposite. I actually think data modeling and transformations will become more automated. I think we'll have less work going on in modeling things because I think the AI, the LLMs, will eventually be able to do it themselves on the fly better than we do. So I think a lot of that will actually just disappear, become part of the almost the end tool. And I think similarly, you know, connecting to your data sources will also kind of just become automated. So I feel like the stack will actually simplify. It will simplify a lot instead of become more complex. I don't know if that's particularly controversial, but that's what I sprang to mind.
Let's keep an eye on it. We'll see what people are talking about. All right, enough of us chatting. This is the first episode of All Things Being Sequel with Lucy Alexander from the FT. So Lucy, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Let's do a very quick background before we jump into the world of data at the FT. A little bit on your analytics career. Channel 4, Burberry, ASOS, and now the FT.
Yeah.
Those are big names.
Yes, they are big names. And it's not completely accidental that that's what my... I was quite careful about where I wanted to work. I have a certain type of company that I believe I like, mainly because that's the only type of company so far I've worked for. But I like these medium-sized, established, well-known brands because I think it's really interesting to understand how they optimize, like how do they keep going. It's different when you're a startup and you're disrupting things. You've got completely different imperatives. But when you're really, really established in a heritage brand like the FT and you've got a lot of way of quality behind you, you're kind of, I don't know, the way you have to think is different. It suits me.
Of those ones, was ASOS the most like a startup? I know a little bit about them because my sister worked there, so I'm just trying to think what data was like there.
Yes, ASOS was actually very good, I think, in how it used data. And the company itself was like a startup in some ways. You know, the board was very, very accessible. It was a very, very young culture. There weren't any real formalities. You know, it was a really social place to be. And that was wonderful in that sense. It was going through a bit of a transformation data-wise when we were there, acquiring a lot of Adobe software. And so a lot of the time that I was there was spent getting up to speed with that and starting using that as a company and all of the change management that goes around that. So it was an exciting time to be there. We also had a really kind of thriving data science team looking at recommendations and, you know, how to reduce things like returns, which are a big issue for that type of retailer.
I know they're a big issue because my wife returns things on ASOS
every week. Yes, well, as does, you know, a lot of people, and that is, you know, part of the problem. But it's a problem of their own making in a way because they made it fantastically easy to do that, and that's a big part of why the business was so successful. So it was a kind of really interesting way of trying to approach that problem.
Did they still have sample sales when you were at ASOS?
They did have sample sales, yeah, for sure.
I've got a £10 pair of Hunter Wellies from an ASOS sample sale.
They're really great. Well, I think you get a good discount. Anyway, we could talk about this or whatever. Like, we get a good discount. So the sample sales, in a sense, weren't as exciting as they were at Burberry, where it was genuinely like people were queuing from 4 or 5 a.m. To get in there, and there was a much more of a vibrant competitiveness about the products that
were because the price point's so high, right? So any sample sale like this one is nice.
That's significant, cool. Yes.
How would ASOS compare to Burberry? Just Burberry's obviously, I guess, less volume, higher prices.
Yes, you're absolutely right.
It's the opposite, very high volume, right? How does... I always find it interesting how you do data in that kind of environment where it's less, still high volumes, but it's different type of volume, right?
As companies, they were very, very different. And I look back now and I think that Burberry was very much more similar to this in terms of how it was run. It was a highly, highly professional environment, which I really liked. It had a hugely strong sense of its own brand, which permeated everything, you know, everything down to the pencils that you were allowed to use and things like that. It was highly controlled in that way, but it was also very, very nurturing. So I think it was very interesting for me from the perspective of watching it as a business run. It was also doing really, really well. When I was there, it was going through a massive kind of up cycle. And it was under Angela Ahrens, who was a CEO that I still to this day kind of look back on and think she was absolutely nailing it in terms of how she nurtured people. Or at least that was the perception I had as a very lowly person. I felt like she was doing great stuff for me as an individual. Yeah. You're right, from an analytics point of view, especially web analytics, we had the opposite issues really at that time. And bear in mind, this is more than 10 years ago now, or around 10 years ago. You know, the online volumes were not so high, whereas at ASOS, obviously, they're just vast. Plus, you've got 70,000 products or something, just an enormous, enormous catalogue of stuff. So it does mean that things like A/B testing, which was a thing big time at ASOS, obviously, at the time we were there, wasn't something that we were really doing in earnest at the time at Burberry. I know things are transformed at Burberry, and their data department now is absolutely brilliant. And it was wonderful to work even then there. But they were also going through a bit of an... I think it was that time where web analytics was undergoing a lot of changes in terms of what software people were using, how they were using it, the way that they were interrogating that data, the way the business responded to it and what it needed. They were great to have side by side because they were totally different challenges, almost in the same sort of sector.
A/B testing, is that something that Burberry would... The reason I'm sort of asking is it's a very strong brand. It's a very strong... I feel like they are not necessarily quickly iterating because they protect their... Almost like Apple. The brand is so strong that you can't just be like, let me change these words quickly and see how people react to it. They'll be like, maybe I'm wrong.
The answer is I don't know. You know, as I said, at that time I wasn't aware of that happening really at all. But I think the same way of working exists here, which is that way over and above the consideration of optimizing for clicks and things like that is the preservation of the quality of this brand. It just permeates everything. And that does make you risk averse. And it kind of runs contrary a bit to the sort of test and learn culture that we're used to from hearing, you know, Booking.com and these giant, amazingly advanced sort of ways of evolving a site almost hands off, you know, in some ways. Doesn't work like that here. Everyone is very invested in the balance between these types of gains, but also like what are the potential implications of that, you know, for the longer term. It's very easy to optimize in a way which actually does do you damage down the line. So we were always trying to like think of the implications of like also the compound effect of one test after another.
Yeah, I think it's a general thing about how you run a company almost. Are you going to optimize and quickly sort of feel where customers are and move that way? Or are you going to sort of almost random walk in a way? Or are you going to have the idea of what it should be and come from that angle, right? That this is our brand, this is who we are. I think it's just two different ways of you can build product the same way. You can either have a vision and build it, or you can sort of quickly iterate and feel how customers react to your product, right? Without missing maybe the same strong feeling of where you are, but anyway.
Yeah, I think that's true. And I think definitely at the places which are kind of started out being digital, you know, like ASOS, that sense of constant iteration and evolution as we go along for a core market which is very, very large is absolutely valid and makes tons of sense.
Yes.
I think when you're looking at companies like this who have historically responded quite strongly to something, been quite ahead of the market in doing so. That has been a very efficient strategy here. You know, we've really been able to stay ahead through making bigger decisions, but not so many, you know, not constant decision making, which is disorientating for our readers, because actually our readers do want stability as well.
It is maybe more just like mass market versus more of a niche, right? If you're a mass market, you have to respond all the time to everything, and because you have to cover everything. And the other way, you sort of...
I think there's a real luxury, and I use that word sort of a bit casually here, but there is a real luxury in not having to respond to fashion in that way, into the kind of the changing dynamics of a much broader group of people. It's really nice to kind of be able to focus on doing a certain thing really, really well.
Yeah.
And it's also lovely to work in those companies too, because, you know, you're less buffeted by the tide the whole time. You know, you're able to really invest in what you believe is the right thing to do.
Yeah. More long-term thinking as well.
It's more long-term thinking, and that's good training, because that's a different data requirement, you know, for us. We're there to enable decision making, but we definitely lean towards trying to push towards more strategic decision making rather than a responsive way of working the whole time.
All right, so yeah, awesome brands, but why did you get into data in the first place? And did you mean to?
No, not at all. I think I'm one of a large group of people who was really, really unclear about what the future held for them for quite a long time. I tenaciously sort of didn't make a decision about what I should be until well into my 20s. That was borne about by, I think, education. You know, they like to keep things broad, and I did the IB, so I never really had to hone down on anything particularly. And then at university, I did a humanities subject, so really I came in an unconventional route. I was always good at maths and science. I always really liked that, and I was a bit worried that I was going down a path where that was just not being really used much. And actually, a job that we haven't discussed, which was my first job, was at the Telegraph. I was on the graduate scheme there, and I was being cycled through some commercial teams who were all absolutely lovely, but it wasn't for me, let's just say that. And I felt quite uncomfortable actually in some of the ways of working there. But one person who was sort of like a shining light there was the woman who did analytics. And I thought, this is a great job. Every morning she went to the editorial briefing and she told them numbers, and they were riveted by this. And I could see the power that this spreadsheet had. I mean, this was back when spreadsheets were like actually in Excel and very carefully guarded and everything. And she said to me, you know, if you break this, I will kill you. even when I was allowed to look at it, it was very much under like sort of supervision. I just saw the power of it influencing these really impressive senior people. And I thought, this is it. This is great, because she is so autonomous in this role. I liked the way she worked. And that was what it was really that set me down that path. So I very quickly left the Telegraph and went to Channel 4 to do research, which was the closest I could find to what she'd done. And then from there, I moved into web analytics. And I was also inspired by the analytics team at Channel 4 at the time, who were just wonderful and like incredibly generous with their time and allowed me to kind of like look over their shoulder a lot. It was just an evolutionary thing. I just saw this particular group more and more as becoming where I wanted to go. And I was accumulating knowledge as I went along, and it kind of then ended up being, you know, what I've stuck to over the years. And it was when I came here that I really understood the proper potential of it for me. You know, it fitted me here better. And that's why I've, you know, been so thrilled to be here for as long as I have, and continue to be thrilled, you know, just still find it fun and challenging.
That's super interesting. So a chance meeting on a kind of, because the Telegraph graduate scheme, one of those things where you jump around all the departments.
Every month,
A friend of mine ended up being a Java developer by accident, did the same thing.
Right.
He was like, okay. it's funny how those things work. But yeah, you managed to meet someone who basically started all of this, which is pretty cool.
Well, I think, you know, this is still the case today. What people are learning at school, the kind of careers advice they have, is absolutely the tip of the iceberg. There is no understanding of what jobs are available to you. And so one of the strengths of a grad scheme is that you suddenly see, wow, there's all these jobs I've never even heard of before. And so we do a little bit of outreach here to younger people to just say, like, these jobs exist and they're great. And they're fun, and this is why you should maybe think about it if you're this way minded. And it doesn't have to be that you've got a maths background necessarily, as long as you're a problem solver, you're analytical, and you like those kind of challenges.
Do you have and we'll go into the FT now and kind of where data comes into that, but on those outreaches to younger people or just anyone really, do you sometimes still have to explain that the FT isn't just the newspaper that people see, and the data is like underpins so much of it, because there's probably a bit of a kind of old school view about all the kind of newspaper groups that, like, where does data, where does tech really come into that company?
Sure. I heard that valid as well. You know, I think it's not obvious that this should be such a data-led company as it is. I mean, maybe it is obvious because it's about money and finance and everyone is just so happy and comfortable looking at charts for the most part, you know, and numbers and all of those kind of core things to this job. But it's more the way that data is considered here and the kind of high value that's placed on it and the way that people are comfortable to make decisions based on data and typically don't find it threatening, which is the thing that enables it to be really, I don't know, sort of on the cutting, sort of towards the cutting edge at least, let's say. I don't want to oversell it, but towards the cutting edge on a lot of these things, which has been fun to work in. But yeah, we obviously have to say we're not talking about the printing press here. We're actually, this is mostly digital now, and that's, you know, that's how we work, like any other digital based company.
Must be nice though, because I think a lot of the problems when we speak to data and analytics teams is that sometimes it's hard to get buy-in higher up, whereas, like you said, the entirety of this organization is pretty comfortable with numbers, charts, like analyzing something. So it kind of maybe takes a lot of those challenges near the top of an organization.
Absolutely. We are so lucky here. I mean, when I joined 8 years ago, we had Tom Betts on the board, you know, who is still, you know, a giant of this, you know, this industry. Someone that I, you know, admire so much as well. And we've had just tremendous buy-in at that level, you know, just a respected voice in the mix. And we've got Kate Sargent now, he's our CDO, and another respected voice in the mix, who's also brilliant. And it's great because it means that you don't have to fight those battles. Those aren't the battles that we're fighting. You know, we've got different things. There's always going to be things that we're trying to do, but we don't have a particular issue here with getting data respected in the appropriate way. It's just not been the case since I've been here.
That's awesome. And your role is Director of Insight and Analytics.
That's right, yeah.
What does that mean?
Well, I think it probably means a lot of different things depending on which company you work for, but here specifically, I look after the centralized sort of insight generation function. Now, that's not to say I'm the only team doing that. There are other great kind of research and insight teams around the company in more specific areas, but we are the central team. So we do experimentation, we do audience feedback, we do strategic analytics. So anything which is kind of to SMG level, so the senior management group level or the board, we try and address the big questions of the day, and we would also anticipate the news events and understand how we should be reacting to it. And we also have a fantastic team in Sofia in Bulgaria who look after specialist titles, so we have other publications as well. Really what we're here to do is make great decisions or enable great decisions to be made as quickly as we reasonably can whilst also making them, you know, correct. And I know that's the sort of tension that everyone is experiencing, is how do you get these kind of recommendations and conclusions quickly whilst not compromising the integrity of what you're doing. So yeah, that's what I kind of think about all day long.
Nice. And then it's a bit of a loaded question on top of that, but like, what do you see, having now led this team for a long time and been in other companies, like what's the main point of an analytics and insights function? And the reason I ask is there's lots of kind of heat going around data teams about providing value, and whether that's business value or ROI or whatever it might be, because obviously there's been a big explosion in buying tools and kind of getting everything on cloud software, like all these things. And it's like, what's the underlying point?
Yeah. Well, I think it's valid to ask what is the value that we're bringing. I really do think that's a reasonable question. And I think that it obviously can cause kind of defensiveness and stuff, but that is because it's very hard to quantify and people are a bit put off by the challenge of trying to do that. So we're at the moment going through this. One of my colleagues is looking to do exactly what you've described, and it's easier in pockets. I think it's kind of easier for experimentation to assign a value to something. You make a decision, it's either better or worse. You're either saving the company from a bad decision or you're encouraging a company to make a good decision. There's an easier thing to quantify, and I think that we're relatively good at doing that. Where it's much, much harder is you do a piece of insight, it might lead to 5 or 6 different decisions that kind of subtly go out. They're not all actioned at the same time. It may be mindset shift in there, which has its own inherent value. How are we going to work out that? So we're going to come up with an imperfect formula at the end of the day. But I I think it's enough for me to know that we are in the right conversations, directing the kind of flow of decisions in the right way, and that we are an active partner in those at the right times. Because I think where the question marks mostly hang over data teams is when they're involved right in the last minute. What they're doing is a lot of reporting about things that have happened, and they're not seen as a partner in that process. And that's the work that we've been trying to do for a long time, is to be seen as partners with the senior leadership, so that we can be included ahead of time and not just at the end when we're kind of retrospectively looking at performance of features and products.
Sort of in the decision-making process instead of, could you analyze what happened, you know, like afterwards, getting thrown a task that's already been predefined, really?
Yeah. Totally. And if you're, you know, if you're doing predictive analytics, if you're much more in the like what is going to happen type world, obviously that's easier, you know, in a sense. But even for things where you're determining what has happened, say something has happened of a kind of a reasonable size and weight, it's working with your stakeholders to even formulate the questions in a way that get the best outcomes. Yeah. And we are in a really great place to do that. You know, you ask an open question to us, we know what to do with that. We will go and find the right answer. And it's just that kind of mindset shift and the analytical thinking that is really important to try and encourage.
Yeah,
it's a long process.
Yeah, so something really nice. I'm going to butcher this, but there's a guy called Darren at ITV that had posted recently about something important an analyst or analytics team can do is, like, it's almost like show you're working in maths, right? Like, show everything you got to the point of giving the insights off. And if those aren't actioned or it doesn't result in what you maybe thought it did, there's still all that great work and there's something to show. So yeah, it's like what you said, when you get brought in at the last minute, you'll often just give the answer, but you don't really get a chance to explain everything that went into that.
Yeah, completely. I mean, we are very big here on reusing the capabilities that we do, right? We don't want to constantly be reactive, designing something from scratch, tossing it away at the end of it. We want everything we use, whether it is a script that we're running in SQL or whatever, to be applicable to some other thing. And we do that with it in mind. So trying to be less customized, less minutely bespoke to every single request, and a bit more, reusable in the future.
Everything's a bit crazy in data just now.
Yeah.
I mean, you could argue the world, but we're not going to get into that on this podcast. Is there something in your mind that's the biggest challenge as the leader of an analytics team, or even just a wider data team at the FT? Like, what are the challenges that you're getting thrown now and in the last kind of few months compared to maybe a few years ago? Like, what's the big change or challenge?
I think what we're grappling with now is a slightly strange hinterland between potentially normal times, I don't want to say normal times, but like more normal, and the craziness of the last 6 years, you know, where everything was thrown up in the air, things were unpredictable, you couldn't really refer back to the previous year's volumes and traffic and stuff. It was all just another world, really, to be honest, and it was one thing after another. And I think now we're trying to look to the future in a much more stable sense as much as we possibly can and say, okay, are things predictable again? You know, we have a big year for elections, for example, so that's something that we're thinking about specifically here. I know that, you know, in a sense, we're talking a bit about AI. I'm really, really hesitant to, like, you know, launch into that with my two cents. But I think that there is a lot of amazing opportunity and concern that all of these seismic changes bring about. And it's just how to use that to stay ahead of the curve, like how to use it intelligently so that you're always competitive, not be too scared of anything that's coming around the corner, just really kind of grasp the potential that it has. And I think that that is the direction that we're particularly taking here, is be very open-minded to it where we can, cautious about where it potentially impinges on us, but otherwise understand how we can use it to our advantage.
Yeah, and that's, I mean, you kind of answered some of this already, but you mentioned AI and, like, everyone talks about ChatGPT.
Yeah, yeah.
We were actually in the hotel last night and the two guys next to us were talking about ChatGPT, and like, you can't go anywhere, and like, nobody I've ever met understands anything about what I do. And now I'm like, yeah, it's like a kind of AI company, and they're like, oh
yeah.
And so everyone has a,
you work for OpenAI.
I'm like, yeah, sure. The chat from your world would be that there's an article every day that ChatGPT or LLMs are going to take the role of software developers, right. It's going to take the role of analysts. Mm-hmm. Like, they probably, for me, they missed the point a little bit, but I won't share my opinion right now. What do you think? Is there opportunity to work together with tools like that?
Yeah, well, yeah, I definitely think there is an opportunity to work together with them. I think that there are two kind of conversations really that exist. There is the truly new about this area, which is in the realm of, you know, how you can use large language models to either make life more efficient or whatever, about your workflow, whatever the potential use case is. And then there's rebranding machine learning as AI in a kind of nonsense way, and then making everything sound really exciting. And I think from, you know, conferences and all of the meetups that I do, it's very clear that everyone is a bit bored of that. People have been working in this way for a long time. It is absolutely nothing new, and it's interesting just to see the light shine on it and what it does to your colleagues and what it does to this area, and how attractive suddenly these areas that have actually been in existence for quite a long time seem with this gloss on them. And I think there's something to navigate there, to be honest, for data teams to say, actually, we own this space. This has been something we've been doing for a long time. It's not actually massively different.
It feels like we have to say it. All of us do not like saying AI. I don't think many of us don't.
Exactly.
Because we're like, we've done this for 10 years. We've never called it that before. But we have to, in a, almost to take the space and say, no, this is what we do.
To claim it.
Yeah, exactly. In a way, right? Because otherwise, you know, there's so much noise.
I absolutely agree with that. I think that there is. I think that many people who work in this particular part of companies tend to not want to kind of play the game.
Yeah.
You know, it seems a bit grubby to like launch yourself into something that you know in the back of your mind is actually a bit silly in some ways. But I do think that there is a real imperative on us to claim that space and to say, this is, we have experts here, or like, you know, highly qualified people who've been doing this a long time. And let's please recognize that in the path forward, and more than recognize it, let's kind of, where ownership is appropriate, let's make sure that the right people are leading those conversations and it's not just been taken over because it's attractive.
Yes, I say it's great that you recognize it can bring value. Actually, we've been doing it for a while.
Yeah, and it has been generating value all this time.
Now, that's great, let's do it together, right?
I
think the worry is that a lot of people will be like, this is a complete new thing, it's never existed before. I'm going to build a new team, I'm going to invest money over here.
Yeah.
Or was it you were doing it over there for less?
Yeah. It's like many of these things, it's a bit of a tightrope of not making it sound too new so that it's threatening, but also you have been doing it, but also just allowing the gloss to come off a little bit and to say, okay, great, we'll take some of the shine on that, and, you know, it will help us, you know, achieve some of our, you know, the outcomes that we're working towards as well.
Is there a little bit of like, might not be here, but some things that we see and speak to people about, there's almost like a weird, unrealistic expectation of what ChatGPT or AI can actually do.
Right.
So it's like, we have this data and it's like one single spreadsheet with some information in it. And they're like, we want to do AI. And it's like, that's not the point.
And very worrying. This is what worries me, is the sort of lack of understanding of the fundamental requirement of anything like that. You know, the volume of data, the quality of data that you need. There's a reason that it is being done in these sort of localized ways by these giants. It's not easy for a small, well, it's basically impossible for most small businesses to be able to do anything at all like that. And I think having that awareness is good as well. I do have people come to me with anxiety about their role and is it going to be taken over. We have also experimented, you know, with trying to understand, can it do a bit of analysis? And, you know, the answer is not at the moment very reliably. And it's hard to unpick. It's impossible for someone who doesn't have a good, solid qualification or background in it to be able to determine what has gone wrong if something has gone wrong. You know, it's very dangerous to me to be in the wrong hands without a kind of good level of governance over it.
And if you work at a brand like the FT, where, like you said, everything is so protected, like, the quality is kind of above all else, you wouldn't want to be trusting something like a large language model in the hands of someone that's not hugely data literate and then actually making a decision based on that. Like, that's terrifying.
I think that that is definitely, does sound worrying now you say it like that. It's not worlds away to me from people making bad decisions with data, historically anyway. You know, if you have a democratic kind of data infrastructure like we have here, you know, we try to anyway, people have access to Looker dashboards in abundance, and are encouraged to go and self-serve, for example, they can make some bad decisions that way too. You know, that is why it's so important to try and make sure that the data fluency of your company is something that you have an ongoing interest in. There's good work being done in other teams within the data department to try and make sure that that is always the case here.
Nice.
a few quick fire questions.
Sure thing.
Maybe not actually super quick fire, but let's see. Yeah. Given the name of the podcast, more of a fun pun than being focused on SQL. But you mentioned kind of your background, kind of maths, science, into research, Excel spreadsheets, SQL scripts. Do you see the skill of an analyst ever really deviating hugely from using SQL almost daily?
Well, I think ever is a long time. I think if we say ever, then I think 100% it will stop using SQL at some point. I just can't see it going on forever. But I think that for now, people will continue to use it. It's a good way of doing a job. You know, it's a lovely language to use in many ways, and it's efficient. I do think that things are evolving and people are coming out of university with new skills and ways of working that they want to continue doing, and it's kind of incumbent on us to enable that for them. So certainly with my team, I'm absolutely agnostic as to how they do their analysis, as long as it's sensible. I know they shouldn't be doing anything crazy, but you know, I do trust them a lot to make those decisions for themselves and to work in the way that they find comfortable and good. So I think that if you run a kind of a team in that way, things are going to evolve, definitely.
Yeah, no, yeah, it's a good way to do it. I think also a lot of the people I've spoke to, that SQL is a really nice foundation.
Yes.
Just to get used to dealing in that space, and almost it's applicable to almost any company.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, on top of that, you can add other ways of working, other tools, other methodologies, which it seems like a sensible way to go.
We do require that people are able to write SQL here. It is just fundamental to our job. That's how we get the data out.
Yeah.
And I think that having a comfort with it and starting to do things in a slightly more creative way in SQL, you know, is really, really rewarding when you get it right, I think. And it just makes your analysis so much easier and quicker and more productive. So we do look to people to really expand their SQL knowledge, and that will continue for, I think, the foreseeable, certainly.
Maybe not forever, though.
But not forever. I really don't think.
We'll never know, so it's fine.
True.
I think I'm going to try and ask this question in every show. Let's see how it goes.
Okay.
But if you were starting back your analytics career today, or you were mentoring someone kind of early in their career, which I'm sure you probably do you have any advice or like something you would say to them to kind of help them stand out? So you mentioned that person at the Telegraph, like kind of almost wowing you with the ability to influence people with these numbers.
Yeah.
Like, is there something, I don't know, that you think would really help them get noticed, maybe, is the right way? I don't know.
I think this is so hard. I mean, I think that some people don't want to be noticed in that way. You know, it's not for everyone to be in the limelight the whole time. And I think particularly amongst analytics professionals, that can be very uncomfortable for some people. I understand that. I'm not a big public speaker, for example. I prefer that the quality of my work speaks for itself. However, you know, I'm sort of older now and I'm less idealistic and more realistic, and I do know that if you do want to stand out, there is quite a bit of work to do on your side for that to happen. You know, you have to be visible. You have to have some confidence in your own opinions as well, and the solidity of your recommendations, because I see businesses looking towards the analytics team so keenly for guidance on, you know, on what they should be doing next. And the analysts that succeed here anyway are the ones that give that guidance, you know, confidently. And then tremendous trust is built. And that's where you really see the gain. So I don't think it's a kind of mysterious thing. I think you have to be present. You have to, I mean, not literally physically nowadays, but, you know, you have to be willing to contribute beyond just the absolute scope of your job. I think that that still exists. And yeah, the ones that I see flourishing are the ones who are out there, not afraid of the senior management team, not afraid to give recommendations quite high up in the food chain, and who are just getting their work out there. So yeah, I would say that my guidance would be confident, and please don't feel that because you're junior, you mustn't make your voice heard.
Were you like that from the beginning of your career, or did you learn it?
No, I was not. Absolutely not.
can see your brain working.
No!
I did not do
I
that.
Was not like that, no, at all. You know, my feedback for the first sort of like 8 years maybe of my career was like, and it seems funny to my interior voice, but I'll say it anyway, was like, you're being too nice. You know, you're too quiet, you're too deferential, definitely. You know, this is what I was taught growing up. You know, this was absolutely, I was just projecting what I thought was the right thing to do. It's not to say don't be nice and don't be deferential, but you don't have to wait until you're yourself, a kind of older person, to have confidence in your own opinions. Yeah. You know, you can project your own voice confidently from a young age, as long as, you know, you're not disrespectful or anything else. No, it's very, very hard, and I'm saying it now from the perspective of a lot of hindsight.
Yeah.
But I do see young people in my team who have those qualities, and it's just wonderful.
Yeah.
And it feels like this is a good place to be able to hone that as well. And actually, we'll get onto it right now. So Eric and I were talking on the way in that the kind of abundance of really strong female leadership at the FT, it just seems a bit nuts, because like all the companies that I've ever worked with, there's so many, there's like, people talk about lack of diversity in data, lack of diversity in tech. Every communication I've had with any senior data person at the FT has been a female. And is it by design? Is it like, I don't know, you're inside the organization, but like, how do you explain it? For people that say it's such a big struggle to do it, the FT are nailing it, so.
Yeah, well, I think from that perspective, from a kind of gender perspective, we are nailing it. I will say, like, women are half of the population, so the kind of skew that you see so often is really not okay. And we're in a leadership team led by a woman, right? So our CDO is a woman, which is wonderful, and there are 5 people on the leadership team, and 3 of them are women and 2 are men. So it's not as absolutely out of whack as maybe it does feel, but that is still quite strongly skewed in one direction.
Yeah.
I just want to say, like, it is an indicator that the FT does put its money where its mouth is on this type of thing. Like, it actually does hire women in senior positions and then make them love working there. You know, we've all been here so long. I've been here 8 years and I'm like the newbie in these positions. And the reason for that is that when it comes to the points in a woman's career which are full of tension, you know, balancing home life and work life, so for me, you know, having a child, that was when it just came in and just allowed me to thrive in that way by taking a lot of the pressures away that typically would make that very difficult in a lot of other organizations. It just enabled me to balance my home life and my work life, and never judged me for that, or never at least explicitly did ever, you know. And actually I got promoted almost immediately. I got back from maternity leave. It's just things like that are true indicators that they really do stand by it.
And sort of how did that, I'm quite fascinated by that, how did that work? I think obviously I never had a child, but the struggle I see is, you know, either you kind of feel like the stress of having to come back soon, sooner than you want to, because you feel like, or the other one is you're way too long and you're almost forgotten. Like, how's the company balance these two things?
I don't think it's easy ever.
No.
Actually. And I think a big part of what made my coming back here was that 2 or 3 other people were also in exactly the same boat. And so we had, in fact, when I went off on maternity leave, McKinley went off on maternity leave, another of our colleagues. So actually there was a little group. We could compare notes. But I found re-entry to be a bit of a shock.
Yeah,
definitely. It was not easy, but it still was no pressure around it. You know, it was pressure from me, pressure from my own ability to kind of get back into it. But no one else was making that hard for me. And so that was a very, very supportive place to be. And definitely with the team that I have, when it comes up for, you know, questions of this type of leave, we always just say, like, you know, the policy is just like, do what you want to do. Like, it's absolutely fine by us. Just, you know, manage your health, manage the well-being of your family. Like, that is so much more important at the end of the day. And what you get normally as a result of that type of way of working is that people want to stay.
Yeah, I was about to say the loyalty the FT will get from you and the others that were pregnant during that time and come back, you got promoted, like, you remember that way longer than it's much more than a paycheck, right? Like, it's a whole thing.
It's not just the promotion, it's also the flexibility. You know, we understand flexibility so much more now. I mean, I was thinking back to the time where, you know, heavily pregnant, you did have to come in 5 to 3,
like, you know, after June. Pregnant, no thanks.
It's not that fun. But now we're in a completely different world, and so there is just this recognition that, you know, life is much easier if you relax a bit around the edges.
Yeah.
You know, easier, and it's not even noticeable to you, like any loss in productivity or whatever that you're worried about. It actually is just a net win all round to kind of care less about those types of things. People will get the job done still.
Yeah.
They will be okay, hopefully. And, you know, these big life events will be less, you know, less difficult and challenging than they are just by
by design.
By nature, exactly.
Yeah, no, I mean, I've had friends that told their boss they were pregnant and their boss would like sigh about having to get a replacement.
Yeah.
That was like their immediate response. And it's like, thanks. Like,
yeah.
What a lovely way to deal with this.
No,
so yeah, there's definitely a way to do it. And yeah, like I said, it sounds like the FT, and from all my experience chatting to you and the others, that just as a general workplace, it's just very grown up, very nice. Like,
it's very nice. Very, very supportive and collaborative. It's nice. Also, people are really, you know, clever for the most part, and it helps. You have really mature conversations here in general. It's lovely to work here. Not to sell it too hard or anything. Maybe we can edit this out. I don't know.
But it's fine. Yeah. I'm not smart enough to work here. Last question, and I'm conscious we've got a couple of minutes. So is there... I don't know how the FT data team gets structured, but in terms of like, is there goals for 2024 when it comes to data? Or you said the election's obviously playing heavily on the mind. Like, is that, do you have to just kind of not react, but kind of think about those things and how your projects are then structured for the year?
Yeah, I mean, obviously this is a product that's driven by editorial,
yeah,
and the news agenda for the year is packed. Planned events are packed, let alone the seismic things happening all over that we're, you know, buffeted by on a daily basis. We don't really know how they're going to play out either. So we can do a lot of preparation for the things that are planned. Like, we know the back end of the year is going to be pretty intense, and there's lots that we can do for that. In the data world specifically, you know, we're evolving and optimizing our tooling setup. That's going to occupy quite a lot of the first half of the year for me anyway. Yeah. And we just have big plans to kind of relay the foundations. I think like every few years you have to redo your foundations because the world has changed so much.
Yeah.
And it's like, set those up for success, and then you have periods of kind of rapid kind of improvement. So we're going through a big setting the foundation year this year again.
Yeah, you told me at the conference we were at last week that there used to be quiet times in the news. And now it just feels like January to December is just all busy.
We haven't had a quiet time for a long time.
It was like a quiet month.
A really quiet month.
Happening.
Yeah, where everyone agrees to have a quiet month as well, you know. So.
I think generally across not just news but the world.
Just life, yeah.
Like everyone just chill for a month.
Yes, exactly. I wish we could have some agreement on that, because I think, you know, you can only chill for a month when everyone's chilling.
Yes.
It's very hard to relax otherwise.
I remember my old company started hiring people from Sweden, and they'd like, everyone agrees that August is basically just shut down. Is this the same all over Scandinavia?
Same in a lot of places. Yeah. I live in France now.
Yeah, France, exactly. Yeah.
So August is shut. Maybe we should try August shutdown month in the UK.
Yeah, it does. It is lovely, and I think I'm behind it. I'm willing to be here on the ground as one of the front runners for that. I tried to force a summer lull last year, and it sort of worked a bit by reducing meetings and things like that. But I think there's, you know, yeah, it's tough to be on a treadmill constantly, that's for sure.
Yeah. All right, amazing. Thank you so much. We're excited to see what happens with the FT this year, and thank you for the time.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you for having me. It's been a very great pleasure.
So we told you it was going to be a good one. Lucy was awesome. We covered so much in a short period of time. What you didn't see was all of the technical issues and running around the FT office at the start of the recording. But she was awesome. Loads of really interesting insights. We obviously touched upon the FT leadership team and focus on diversity, equity and inclusion, which was really, really great, actually. And something that I think most people will take away from this. That was really good. What about you?
Yeah, also the chat we had about going sort of beyond the scope of your job was really interesting. Yeah, sort of resonated a lot with me and how my early career went. Getting your voice heard, not being afraid of your seniors. They should be there to help. You should ask them for help. I think there's a lot to take away there. I didn't when I was very differential when I was junior. I think it's a bad thing. I think you should be able to speak up a lot more. And that's what, like Lucy was talking about, it takes a while to learn that in a job and then really get heard and even learn that as a person, because you're always told to do the opposite at school. So that was really interesting.
Right, that's it for episode one. We'll be back in a couple of weeks' time with Andrew Madsen, who's the VP of Data at Arizona State University, and a bit of a LinkedIn celebrity with 76,000 or 77,000 followers all around helping people into the world of data. So yeah, really looking forward to that.